Burton lay on his back on a pile of tree leaves and puffed on a cigar. It was excellent, and in the London of his day would have cost at least a shilling. He didn't feel so minute and unworthy now. The stars were inanimate matter, and he was alive. No star could ever know the delicious taste of an expensive cigar. Nor could it know the ecstasy of holding a warm, well-curved woman next to it. On the other side of the fire, half or wholly lost in the grasses and the shadows, were the Triestans. The liquor had uninhibited them, though part of their sense of freedom may have come from joy at being alive and young again. They giggled and laughed and rolled back and forth in the grass and made loud noises while kissing. And then, couple by couple, they retreated into the darkness, or at least made no more loud noises. The little girl had fallen asleep by Alice. The firelight flickered over Alice's handsome, aristocratic face and bald head and on the magnificent body and long legs. Burton suddenly knew that all of him had been resurrected. He definitely wasn't the old man who, during the last 16 years of his life, had paid so heavily for the many fevers and sicknesses that had squeezed him dry in the tropics. Now he was young again, healthy, and possessed by the old, clamoring demon. Yet he had given his promise to protect her. He could make no move, say no word which she could interpret as seductive. Well, she wasn't the only woman in the world. As a matter of fact, he had the whole world of women, if not at his disposal, at least available to be asked. That is, he did, if everybody who had died on Earth was on this planet. She would be only one among many billions, and possibly 36 billion if Frigate's estimate was correct. But there was, of course, no such evidence that this was the case. The hell of it was that Alice might as well be the only one in the world at this moment, anyway. He couldn't get up and walk off into the darkness looking for another woman, because that would leave her and the child unprotected. She certainly wouldn't feel safe with Monat and Kaz, nor could he blame her. They were so terrifyingly ugly. Nor could he entrust her to Frigate, if Frigate returned tonight, which Burton doubted, because the fellow was an unknown quantity. Burton suddenly laughed loudly at his situation. He had decided that he might as well stick it out for tonight. This thought set him laughing again, and he didn't stop until Alice asked him if he was all right. "More right than you will ever know," he said, turning his back to her. He reached into his grail and extracted the last item. This was a small, flat stick of chicle-like substance. Frigate, before leaving, had remarked that their unknown benefactors must be American, otherwise they wouldn't have thought of providing chewing gum. After stubbing out his cigar on the ground, Burton popped the stick into his mouth. He said, "This has a strange but rather delicious taste. Have you tried yours?" "I am tempted, but I imagine I'd look like a cow chewing her cud."
"Forget about being a lady," Burton said. "Do you think that beings with the power to resurrect you would have vulgar tastes?"
Alice smiled slightly and said, "I really wouldn't know," and placed the stick in her mouth. For a moment they chewed idly, looking across the fire at each other. She was unable to look him full in the eyes for more than a few seconds at a time. Burton said, "Frigate mentioned that he knew you, of you, rather. Just who are you, if you will pardon my unseemly curiosity?"
"There are no secrets among the dead," she replied lightly, "or among the ex-dead, either."
She had been born Alice Pleasance Little on April 25, 1852. Burton was 30 then. She was the direct descendant of King Edward III and his son John of Gaunt. Her father was Dean of Christ Church College of Oxford and co-author of a famous Greek-English lexicon. Little and Scott, Burton thought. She had had a happy childhood, an excellent education, and had met many famous people of her times. Gladstone, Matthew Arnold, the Prince of Wales, who was placed under her father's care while he was at Oxford. Her husband had been Reginald Jervis Hargreaves, and she had loved him very much. He had been a country gentleman, liked to hunt, fish, play cricket, raise trees, and read French literature. She had 3 sons, all captains, 2 of whom died in the Great War of 1914-1918. This was the second time that day that Burton had heard of the Great War.
She talked on and on as if drink had loosened her tongue, or as if she wanted to place a barrier of conversation between her and Burton. She talked of Dinah, the tabby kitten she had loved when she was a child, the great trees of her husband's arboretum, how her father, when working on his lexicon, would always sneeze at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, no one knew why. At the age of 80, she was given an honorary Doctor of Letters by the American University, Columbia, because of the vital part she had played in the genesis of Mr. Dodgson's famous book. She neglected to mention the title, and Burton, though a voracious reader, did not recall any works by a Mr. Dodgson.
"That was a golden afternoon indeed," she said, despite the official meteorological report. "On July 4th, 1862, I was 10. My sisters and I were wearing black shoes, white openwork socks, white cotton dresses, and hats with large brims."
Her eyes were wide, and she shook now and then as if she were struggling inside herself, and she began to talk even faster.
"Mr. Dodgson and Mr. Duckworth carried the picnic baskets. We set off in our boat from Folly Bridge, up the Isis, upstream for a change. Mr. Duckworth rowed stroke. The drops fell off his paddle like tears of glass on the smooth mirror of the Isis, and—"
Burton heard the last words as if they had been roared at him. Astonished, he gazed at Alice, whose lips seemed to be moving as if she were conversing at a normal speech level. Her eyes were now fixed on him, but they seemed to be boring through him into a space and a time beyond. Her hands were half raised as if she were surprised at something and could not move them. Every sound was magnified. He could hear the breathing of the little girl, the pounding of her heart and Alice's, the gurgle of the workings of Alice's intestines and of the breeze as it slipped across the branches of the trees. From far away, a cry came. He rose and listened. What was happening? Why the heightening of senses? Why could he hear their hearts, but not his? He was also aware of the shape and texture of the grass under his feet. Almost he could feel the individual molecules of the air as they bumped into his body. Alice, too, had risen. She said, "What's happening?" And her voice fell against him like a heavy gust of wind. He didn't reply, for he was staring at her. Now it seemed to him he could really see her body for the first time, and he could see her, too, the entire Alice. Alice came toward him with her arms held out, her eyes half shut, her mouth moist. She swayed and she crooned, "Richard, Richard." Then she stopped. Her eyes widened. He stepped toward her, his arms out. She cried, "No," and turned and ran into the darkness among the trees. For a second, he stood still. It didn't seem possible that she, whom he loved as he had never loved anybody, could not love him back. She must be teasing him, that was it. He ran after her and called her name over and over. It must have been hours later when the rain fell against them. Either the effect of the drug had worn off or the cold water helped dispel it, for both seemed to emerge from the ecstasy and the dreamlike state at the same time. She looked up at him as lightning lit their features, and she screamed and pushed him violently. He fell on the grass, but reached out a hand and grabbed her ankle as she scrambled away from him on all fours. "What's the matter with you?" he shouted. Alice quit struggling. She sat down, hid her face against her knees, and her body shook with sobs. Burton rose and placed his hands under her chin and forced her to look upward. Lightning hit nearby again and showed him her tortured face. "You promised to protect me," she cried out. "You didn't act as if you wanted to be protected," he said. "I didn't promise to protect you against a natural human impulse."
"Impulse," she said. "Impulse. My God, I've never done anything like this in my life. I've always been good. I was a virgin when I married, and I stayed faithful to my husband all my life. And now, a total stranger, just like that, I don't know what got into me."
"Then I've been a failure," Burton said, and laughed. But he was beginning to feel regret and sorrow. If only it had been her own will, her own wish, then he would not now be having the slightest bite of conscience. But that gum had contained some powerful drug, and it had made them behave as lovers whose passion knew no limits. She had certainly cooperated as enthusiastically as any experienced woman in a Turkish harem.
"You needn't feel the least bit contrite or self-reproachful," he said gently. "You were possessed. Blame the drug."
"I did it," she said. I wanted to. Oh, what a vile, low whore I am."
"I don't remember offering you any money."
He didn't mean to be heartless. He wanted to make her so angry that she would forget her self-abasement, and he succeeded. She jumped up and attacked his chest and face with her nails. She called him names that a high-bred and gentle lady of Victoria's day should never have known.
Burton caught her wrists to prevent further damage and held her while she spewed more filth at him. Finally, when she had fallen silent and had begun weeping again, he led her toward the campsite. The fire was wet ashes. He scraped off the top layer and dropped a handful of grass, which had been protected from the rain by the tree, onto the embers. By its light, he saw the little girl sleeping, huddled between Kaz and Monat under a pile of grass beneath the iron tree. He returned to Alice, who was sitting under another tree.
"Stay away," she said. "I never want to see you again. You have dishonored me, dirtied me, and after you gave your word to protect me."
"You can freeze if you wish," he said. "I was merely going to suggest that we huddle together to keep warm, but if you wish discomfort, so be it. I'll tell you again that what we did was generated by the drug. No, not generated. Drugs don't generate desires or actions, they merely allow them to be released. Our normal inhibitions were dissolved, and neither one of us can blame ourselves or the other. However, I'd be a liar if I said I didn't enjoy it, and you'd be a liar if you claimed you didn't. So why gash yourself with the knives of conscience?"
"I'm not a beast like you. I'm a good Christian, God-fearing, virtuous woman."
"No doubt," Burton said dryly. "However, let me stress again one thing. I doubt if you would have done what you did if you hadn't wished in your heart to do so. The drug suppressed your inhibitions, but it certainly didn't put in your mind the idea of what to do. The idea was already there. Any action that resulted from taking the drug came from you, from what you wanted to do."
"I know that," she screamed. "Do you think I'm some stupid, simple serving girl? I have a brain. I know what I did and why. It's just that I never dreamed that I could be such a person. But I must have been. Must be."
Burton tried to console her, to show her that everyone had certain unwished-for elements in their nature. He pointed out that the dogma of original sin surely covered this. She was human, therefore she had dark desires in her, and so forth. The more he tried to make her feel better, the worse she felt. Then, shivering with cold and tired of the useless arguments, he gave up. He crawled in between Monat and Kaz and took the little girl in his arms. The warmth of the three bodies and the cover of the grass pile and the feel of the naked bodies soothed him. He went to sleep, with Alice's weeping coming to him faintly through the grass cover.
Chapter 9. When he awoke, he was in the gray light of the false dawn, which the Arabs called the wolf's tail. Monat Kaz and the child were still sleeping. He scratched for a while at the itchy spots caused by the rough-edged grass, and then crawled out. The fire was out. Water drops hung from the leaves of the trees and the tips of the grass blades. He shivered with the cold. But he didn't feel tired nor have any ill effects from the drug as he had expected. He found a pile of comparatively dry bamboo under some grass beneath a tree. He rebuilt the fire with this and in a short time was comfortable. Then he saw the bamboo containers and he drank water from one. Alice was sitting up in a mound of grass and staring sullenly at him. Her skin was ridged with goosebumps.
"Come and get warm," he said.
She crawled out, stood up, walked over to the bamboo bucket, bent down, scooped up water and splashed it over her face. Then she squatted down by the fire, warming her hands over a small flame. If everybody is naked, how quickly even the most modest lose their modesty, he thought. A moment later, Burton heard the rustle of grass to the east. A naked head, Peter Frigates, appeared.
He strode from the grass and was followed by the naked head of a woman. Emerging from the grass, she revealed a wet but beautiful body. Her eyes were large and a dark green, and her lips were a little too thick for beauty, but her other features were exquisite. Frigate was smiling broadly. He turned and pulled her into the warmth of the fire with his hand.
"You look like the cat who ate the canary," Burton said. "What happened to your hand?"
Peter Frigate looked at the knuckles of his right hand. They were swelled, and there were scratches on the back of the hand.
"I got into a fight," he said.
He pointed a finger at the woman who was squatting near Alice and warming herself.
"There was a madhouse down by the river last night. That gum must contain a drug of some sort. You wouldn't believe what people were doing. Or would you? After all, you're Richard Francis Burton. Anyway, all women, including the ugly ones, were occupied one way or another. I got scared at what was going on, and then I got mad. I hit two men with my grail, knocked them out. They were attacking a 10-year-old girl. I may have killed them. I hope I did. I tried to get the girl to come with me, but she ran away into the night. I decided to come back here. I was beginning to react pretty badly from what I'd done to those two men, even if they deserved it. The drug was responsible. It must have released a lifetime of rage and frustration. So I started back here, and then I came across two more men. Only these were attacking a woman. This one. I think she wasn't resisting the idea of intercourse so much as she was their idea of simultaneous attack, if you know what I mean. Anyway, she was screaming, or trying to, and struggling, and they had just started to hit her, so I hit them with my fist and kicked them, and then banged away on them with my grail. And then I took the woman. Her name's Logu, by the way. That's all I know about her, since I can't understand a word of her language. And she went with me. He grinned again. But we never got there. He quit grinning and shuddered. Then we woke up with the rain and lightning and thunder coming down like the wrath of God. I thought that maybe, don't laugh, that it was Judgment Day, that God had given us free rein for a day so he could let us judge ourselves, and now we were going to be cast into the pit. He laughed tightly and said, "I've been an agnostic since I was 14 years old, and I died one at the age of 90. Although I was thinking about calling in a priest then. But the little child that's scared of the old father, God, and hellfire and damnation, he's still down there, even in the old man, or in the young man raised from the dead." "What happened?" Burton said. "Did the world end in a crack of thunder and a stroke of lightning? You're still here, I see, and you've not renounced the delights of sin in the person of this woman." "We found a grailstone near the mountains about a mile west of here. We got lost, wandered around cold, wet, jumping every time the lightning struck nearby. Then we found the grailstone. It was jammed with people, but they were exceptionally friendly, and there were so many bodies it was very warm, even if some rain did leak down through the grass. We finally went to sleep long after the rain quit. When I woke up, I searched through the grass until I found Logu. She got lost during the night somehow. She seemed pleased to see me, though, and I like her. There's an affinity between us. Maybe I'll find out why when she learns to speak English. I tried that, and French, and German, and tags of Russian, Lithuanian, Gaelic, all the Scandinavian tongues, including Finnish, classical Nahuatl, Arabic, Hebrew, Onondaga Iroquois, Ojibwe, Italian, Spanish, Latin, modern and Homeric Greek, and a dozen others. Result? A blank look."
"You must be quite a linguist," Burton said.
"I'm not fluent in any of those," Frigate said. "I can read most of them, but can speak only everyday phrases. Unlike you, I am not master of 39 languages, including pornography."
The fellow seemed to know much about himself, Burton thought. He would find out just how much at a later time.
"I'll be frank with you, Peter," Burton said. "Your account of your aggressiveness amazed me. I hadn't thought you capable of attacking and beating that many men. Your queasiness..."
"It was the gum, of course. It opened the door of the cage." Frigate squatted down by Logu and rubbed his shoulder against hers. She looked at him out of slightly slanted eyes. The woman would be beautiful once her hair grew out. Frigate continued.
I'm so timorous and queasy because I'm afraid of the anger, the desire to do violence that lies not too deeply within me. I fear violence because I am violent. I fear what will happen if I'm not afraid. Hell, I've known that for 40 years. Much good the knowledge has done me. He looked at Alice and said, "Good morning." Alice replied cheerily enough, and she even smiled at Logu when she was introduced. She would look at Burton, and she would answer his direct questions, but she wouldn't chat with him or give him anything but a stern face. Monet Kaz and the little girl, all yawning, came to the fireside. Burton prowled around the edges of the camp and found that the Triestans were gone. Some had left their grails behind. He cursed them for their carelessness and thought about leaving the grails in the grass to teach them a lesson, but he eventually placed the cylinders in depressions on the grailstone. If their owners didn't return, they would go hungry, unless someone shared their food with them. In the meantime, the food in their grails would have to be untouched. He would be unable to open them. They had discovered yesterday that only the owner of a grail could open it. Experimentation with a long stick had determined also that the owner had to touch the grail with his fingers or some part of his body before the lid would open. It was Frigate's theory that a mechanism in the grail was keyed to the peculiar configuration of skin voltage of the owner. Or perhaps the grail contained a very sensitive detector of the individual's brainwaves. The sky had become bright by then. The sun was still on the other side of the 20,000-foot-high eastern mountain. Approximately a half hour later, the grail rock spurted blue flame with a roll of thunder. Thunder from the stones along the river echoed against the mountain. The grails yielded bacon and eggs, ham, toast, butter, jam, milk, a quarter of a cantaloupe, cigarettes, and a cupful of dark brown crystals, which Frigate said was instant coffee. He drank the milk in one cup, rinsed it out in water in a bamboo container, filled the cup with water, and set it by the fire. When the water was boiling, he put a teaspoonful of the crystals into the water and stirred it. The coffee was delicious, and there were enough crystals to provide 6 cups. Then Alice put the crystals into the water before heating it over the fire, and found that it wasn't necessary to use the fire. The water boiled within 3 seconds after the crystals were placed into the cold water. After eating, they washed out the containers and replaced them in the grails. Burton strapped his grail onto his waist. He intended to explore, and he certainly wasn't going to leave the grail on the stone. Though it could do no one but himself any good, vicious people might take it just for the pleasure of seeing him starve. Burton started his language lessons with the little girl and Kaz, and Frigate got Logu to sit in on them. Frigate suggested that a universal language should be adopted because of the many, many languages and dialects, perhaps 50,000 to 60,000 that mankind had used in his several million years of existence, and which he was using along the river. That is, provided that all of mankind had been resurrected. After all he knew about was the few square miles he had seen. But it would be a good idea to start propagating Esperanto, the synthetic language invented by the Polish oculist Dr. Zamenhof in 1887. Its grammar was very simple and absolutely regular, and its sound combinations, though not as easy for everybody to pronounce as claimed, were still relatively easy. And the basis of the vocabulary was Latin, with many words from English and German and other West European languages. "I had heard about it before I died," Burton said, "but I never saw any samples of it. Perhaps it may become useful, but in the meantime, I'll teach these two English." "But most of the people here speak Italian or Slovenian," Frigate said. "That may be true, though we haven't any surveyors yet. However, I don't intend to stay here, you can be sure of that." "I could have predicted that," Frigate muttered. "He always did get restless. He had to move on." Burton glared at Frigate and then started the lessons. For about 15 minutes he drilled them in the identification and pronunciation of 19 nouns and a few verbs: fire, bamboo, grail, man, woman, girl, hand, feet, eye, teeth, eat, walk, run, talk, danger, I, you, they, us. He intended that he should learn as much from them as they from him. In time, he would be able to speak their tongues, whatever they were. The sun cleared the top of the eastern range. The air became warmer, and they let the fire die.
They were well into the second day of resurrection, and they knew almost nothing about this world or what their eventual fate was supposed to be or who was determining their fate. Lev Ruach stuck his big-nosed face through the grass and said, "May I join you?" Burton nodded, and Frigate said, "Sure, why not?" Ruach stepped out of the grass. A short, pale-skinned woman with great brown eyes and lovely, delicate features followed him. Ruach introduced her as Tanya Kowitz. He had met her last night, and they had stayed together since they had a number of things in common. She was of Russian-Jewish descent, was born in 1958 in the Bronx, New York City, had become an English schoolteacher, married a businessman who made a million, and dropped dead when she was 45, leaving her free to marry a wonderful man with whom she had been in love for 15 years. 6 months later, she was dead of cancer. Tanya, not Lev, gave this information, and in one sentence. "It was hell down on the plains last night," Lev said. "Tanya and I had to run for our lives into the woods, so I decided that I would find you and ask if we could stay with you. I apologize for my hasty remarks of yesterday, Mr. Burton. I think that my observations were valid, but the attitudes I was speaking of should be considered in the context of your other attitudes." "We'll go into that some other time," Burton said. "At the time I wrote that book, I was suffering from the vile and malicious lies of the moneylenders of Damascus, and they..." "Certainly, Mr. Burton," Ruach said. "As you say later, I just wanted to make the point that I consider you to be a very capable and strong person, and I would like to join your group. We are in a state of anarchy, if you can call anarchy a state, and many of us need protection." Burton didn't like to be interrupted. He scowled and said, "Please permit me to explain myself. I..." Frigate stood up and said, "Here come the others. Wonder where they've been." Only 4 of the original 9 had come back, however. Maria Tucci explained that they had wandered away together after chewing the gum and eventually ended up by one of the big bonfires on the plains. Then many things had happened. There had been fights and attacks by men on women, men on men, women on men, women on women, and even attacks on children. The group had split up in the chaos. She had met the other 3 only an hour ago while she was searching in the hills for the Grail Stone. Lev added some details. The results of chewing the narcotic gum had been tragic, amusing, or gratifying, depending apparently upon individual reaction. The gum had had an aphrodisiac effect upon many, but it also had many other effects. Consider the husband and wife who had died in Opcine, a suburb of Trieste, in 1899. They had been resurrected within 6 feet of each other. They had wept with joy at being reunited when so many couples had not been. They thanked God for their good luck, though they also had made some loud comments that this world was not what they had been promised. But they had had 50 years of married bliss and now looked forward to being together for eternity. Only a few minutes after both had chewed the gum, the man had strangled his wife, heaved her body into the river, picked up another woman in his arms, and run off into the darkness of the woods with her. Another man had leaped upon a grail stone and delivered a speech that lasted all night, even through the rain. To the few who could hear, and the even fewer who listened, he had demonstrated the principles of a perfect society, and how these could be carried out in practice. By dawn he was so hoarse he could only croak a few words. On earth, he had seldom bothered to vote. A man and a woman, outraged at the public display of carnality, had forcefully tried to separate couples. The results? Bruises, bloody noses, split lips, and 2 concussions, all theirs. Some men and women had spent the night on their knees, praying and confessing their sins. Some children had been badly beaten, raped, or murdered, or all 3, but not everybody had succumbed to the madness. A number of adults had protected the children, or tried to. Ruach described the despair and disgust of a Croat Muslim and an Austrian Jew because their grails contained pork. A Hindu screamed obscenities because his grail offered him meat. A 4th man, crying out that they were in the hands of devils, had hurled his cigarettes into the river. Several had said to him, "Why didn't you give us the cigarettes if you didn't want them?" "Tobacco is the invention of the devil. It was the weed created by Satan in the Garden of Eden." A man said, "At least you could have shared the cigarettes with us. It wouldn't hurt you."
"I would like to throw all the evil stuff into the river," he had shouted. "You're an insufferable bigot and crazy to boot,"
another had replied and struck him in the mouth. Before the tobacco hater could get up off the ground, he was hit and kicked by four others. Later, the tobacco hater had staggered up and, weeping with rage, cried, "What have I done to deserve this, O Lord my God? I've always been a good man. I gave thousands of pounds to charities. I worshipped in thy temple 3 times a week. I waged a lifelong war against sin and corruption. I
know you,"
a woman had shouted. She was a tall, blue-eyed girl with a handsome face and well-curved figure.
"I know you, Sir Robert Smithson."
He had stopped talking and had blinked at her.
"I don't know you. You wouldn't, but you should. I'm one of the thousands of girls who had to work 16 hours a day, 6.5 days a week, so you could live in your big house on the hill and dress in fine clothes, and so your horses and dogs could eat far better than I could. I was one of your factory girls. My father slaved for you. My mother slaved for you. My brothers and sisters, those who weren't too sick or who didn't die because of too little or too bad food, dirty beds, drafty windows, and rat bites, slaved for you. My father lost a hand in one of your machines, and you kicked him out without a penny. My mother died of the white plague. I was coughing out my life too, my fine baronet, while you stuffed yourself with rich foods and sat in easy chairs and dozed off in your big expensive church pew and gave thousands to feed the poor unfortunates in Asia and to send missionaries to convert the poor heathens in Africa. I coughed out my lungs, and I had to go a-whoring to make enough money to feed my kid sisters and brothers. And I caught syphilis, you bloody pious bastard, because you wanted to wring out every drop of sweat and blood I had, and those poor devils like me had. I died in prison because you told the police they should deal harshly with prostitution. You...
Smithson had gone red at first, then pale. Then he had drawn himself up straight, scowling at the woman, and said,
"You whores always have somebody to blame for your unbridled lusts, your evil ways. God knows that I followed his ways."
He had turned and had walked off, but the woman ran after him and swung her grail at him. It came round swiftly. Somebody shouted. He spun and ducked. The grail almost grazed the top of his head. Smithson ran past the woman before she could recover and quickly lost himself in the crowd. Unfortunately, Ruas said, very few understood what was going on because they couldn't speak English.
"Sir Robert Smithson," Burton said. "If I remember correctly, he owned cotton mills and steelworks in Manchester. He was noted for his philanthropies and his good works among the heathens. Died in 1870 or thereabouts at the age of 80. And probably convinced that he would be rewarded in heaven," Levrouach said. "Of course, it would never have occurred to him that he was a murderer many times over. If he hadn't exploited the poor, someone else would have done so." "That is an excuse used by many throughout men's history," Lev said. "Besides, there were industrialists in your country who saw to it that wages and conditions in their factories were improved. Robert Owen was one, I believe."
Chapter 10. "I don't see much sense in arguing about what went on in the past," Friggett said. "I think we should do something about our present situation." Burton stood up.
"You're right, Yank. We need roofs over our heads, tools, God knows what else. But first, I think we should take a look at the cities of the plains and see what the citizens are doing there."
At that moment, Alice came through the trees on the hill above them. Friggett saw her first. He burst out laughing.
"The latest in ladies' wear."
She had cut lengths of the grass with her scissors and plaited them into a 2-piece garment. One was a sort of poncho, which covered her breasts, and the other a skirt which fell to her calves. The effect was strange, though one that she should have expected. When she was naked, the hairless head still didn't detract too much from her femaleness and her beauty, but with the green, bulky, and shapeless garments, her face suddenly became masculine and ugly. The other women crowded around her and examined the weaving of the grass lengths and the grass belt that secured the skirt.
"It's very itchy, very uncomfortable," Alice said, "but it's decent. That's all I can say for it."
Apparently, you didn't mean what you said about your unconcern with nudity in a land where all are nude, Burton said. Alice stared coolly and said, I expect that everybody will be wearing these, every decent man and woman, that is. I suppose that Mrs. Grundy would rear her ugly head here, Burton replied. It was a shock to be among so many naked people, Brigitte said. Even though nudity on the beach and in the private home became commonplace before I died, but it didn't take long for everyone to get used to it. Everyone except the hopelessly neurotic, I suppose. Burton swung around and spoke to the other women. What about you, ladies? Are you going to wear these ugly and scratchy haycocks because one of your sex suddenly decides that she has private parts again? Can something that has been so public become private? Logu, Tanya, and Alice didn't understand him because he spoke in Italian. He repeated in English for the benefit of the last two. Alice flushed and said, What I wear is my business. If anybody else cares to go naked when I'm decently covered, well... Logu hadn't understood a word, but she understood what was going on. She laughed and turned away. The other women seemed to be trying to guess what each one intended to do. The ugliness and the uncomfortableness of the clothing were not the issues. While you females are trying to make up your minds, Burton said, it would be nice if you would take a bamboo pail and go with us to the river. We can bathe, fill the pails with water, find out the situation in the plains, and then return here. We may be able to build several houses or temporary shelters before nightfall. They started down the hills, pushing through the grass and carrying their grails, chert weapons, bamboo spears, and buckets. They hadn't gone far before they encountered a number of people. Apparently many plains dwellers had decided to move out. Not only that, some had also found chert and had made tools and weapons. These had learned the technique of working with stone from somebody, possibly from other primitives in the area. So far, Burton had seen only two specimens of non-Homo sapiens, and these were with him. But wherever the techniques had been learned, they had been put to good use. They passed two half-completed bamboo huts. These were round, one-roomed, and would have conical roofs thatched with the huge triangular leaves from the iron trees and with the long hill grass. One man, using a chert adze and axe, was building a short-legged bamboo bed. Except for a number erecting rather crude huts or lean-tos without stone tools at the edge of the plains, and for a number swimming in the river, the plain was deserted. The bodies from last night's madness had been removed. So far, no one had put on a grass skirt, and many stared at Alice or even laughed and made raucous comments. Alice turned red, but she made no move to get rid of her clothes. The sun was getting hot, however, and she was scratching under her breast garment and under her skirt. It was a measure of the intensity of the irritation that she, raised by strict Victorian upper-class standards, would scratch in public. However, when they got to the river, they saw a dozen heaps of stuff that turned out to be grass dresses. These had been left on the edge of the river by the men and women now laughing, splashing, and swimming in the river. It was certainly a contrast to the beaches he knew. These were the same people who had accepted the bathing machines, the suits that covered them from ankle to neck, and all the other modest devices as absolutely moral and vital to the continuation of the proper society, theirs. Yet, only one day after finding themselves here, they were swimming in the nude, and enjoying it. Part of the acceptance of their unclothed state came from the shock of the resurrection. In addition, there wasn't much they could do about it that first day, and there had been a leavening of the civilized with savage peoples, or tropical civilized peoples who were not particularly shocked by nudity. He called out to a woman who was standing to her waist in the water. She had a coarsely pretty face and sparkling blue eyes. That is the woman who attacked Sir Robert Smithson, Leruach said. I believe her name is Wilfreda Alport. Burton looked at her curiously and with appreciation of her splendid bust. He called out, How's the water? Very nice, she said, smiling. He unstrapped his grail, put down the container which held his chert knife and hand axe, and waded in with his cake of green soap. The water felt as if it was about 10 degrees below his body temperature.
He soaped himself while he struck up a conversation with Wilfrida. If she still harbored any resentment about Smithson, she didn't show it. Her accent was heavily North Country, perhaps Cumberland. Burton said to her, "I heard about your little to-do with the late great hypocrite, the baronet. You should be happy now, though. You're healthy and young and beautiful again, and you don't have to toil for your bread. Also, you can do for love what you had to do for money." There was no use beating around the bush with the factory girl. Not that she had any. Wilfrida gave him a stare as cool as any he had received from Alice Hargreaves. She said, "Now, haven't you the ruddy nerve? English, aren't you? I can't place your accent. London, I'd say, with a touch of something foreign." "You're close," he said, laughing. "I'm Richard Burton, by the way. How would you like to join our group? We've banded together for protection. We're going to build some houses this afternoon. We've got a Grailstone all to ourselves up in the hills." Wilfrida looked at the Tau Seton and the Neanderthal. "They're part of your mob now? I heard about 'em. They say the monsters are manned from the stars, come along in A.D. 2000, they do say." "He won't hurt you," Burton said. "Neither will the subhuman. What do you say?" "I'm only a woman," she said. "What do I have to offer?" "All a woman has to offer," Burton said, grinning. Surprisingly, she burst out laughing. She touched his chest and said, "Now ain't you the clever one. What's the matter, you can't get no girl of your own?" "I had one and lost her," Burton said. That was not entirely true. He wasn't sure what Alice intended to do. He couldn't understand why she continued to stay with his group if she was so horrified and disgusted. Perhaps it was because she preferred the evil she knew to the evil she didn't know. At the moment he himself felt only disgust at her stupidity, but he didn't want her to go. That love he had experienced last night may have been caused by the drug, but he still felt a residue of it. And why was he asking this woman to join them? Perhaps it was to make Alice jealous. Perhaps it was to have a woman to fall back upon if Alice refused him tonight. Perhaps... he didn't know why. Alice stood upon the bank, her toes almost touching the water. The bank was, at this point, only an inch above the water. The short grass continued from the plain to form a solid mat that grew down on the river bed. Burton could feel the grass under his feet as far as he could wade. He threw his soap onto the bank and swam out for about 40 feet and dived down. Here, the current suddenly became stronger and the depth much greater. He swam down, his eyes open until the light failed and his ears hurt. He continued on down and then his fingers touched bottom. There was grass there, too. When he swam back to where the water was up to his waist, he saw that Alice had shed her clothes. She was in closer to the shore, but squatting so that the water was up to her neck. She was soaping her head and face. He called to Frigate. "Why didn't you come in?" "I'm guarding the Grails," Frigate said. "Very good." Burton swore under his breath. He should have thought of that and appointed somebody as a guard. He wasn't, in actuality, a good leader. He tended to let things go to pot, to permit them to disintegrate. Admit it. On Earth, he had been the head of many expeditions, none of which had been distinguished by efficiency or strong management. Yet, during the Crimean War, when he was head of Beetson's irregulars training the wild Turkish cavalry, the Bashi Bazooks, he had done quite well, far better than most, so he shouldn't be reprimanding himself. Lev Ruach climbed out of the water and ran his hands over his skinny body to take off the drops. Burton got out, too, and sat down beside him. Alice turned her back on him, whether on purpose or not, he had no way of knowing, of course. "It's not just being young again that delights me," Lev said in his heavily accented English. "It's having this leg back." He tapped his right knee. "I lost it in a traffic accident on the New Jersey Turnpike when I was 50 years old. He laughed and said, "There was an irony to the situation that some might call fate. I had been captured by Arabs 2 years before when I was looking for minerals in the desert in the State of Israel, you understand." "You mean Palestine," Burton said. "The Jews founded an independent state in 1948,
Lev said. You wouldn't know about that, of course. I'll tell you all about it sometime. Anyway, I was captured and tortured by Arab guerrillas. I won't go into the details. It makes me sick to recall it. But I escaped that night, though not before bashing in the heads of two with a rock and shooting two more with a rifle. The others fled and I got away. I was lucky. An army patrol picked me up. However, 2 years later, when I was in the States driving down the turnpike, a truck, a big semi, I'll describe that later, too, cut in front of me and jackknifed and I crashed into it. I was badly hurt and my right leg was amputated below the knee. But the point of this story is that the truck driver had been born in Syria. So you see, the Arabs were out to get me, and they did, though they did not kill me. That job was done by a friend from Tau Ceti, though I can't say he did anything to humanity except hurry up its doom. What do you mean by that? Burton said. There were millions dying from famine. Even the States were on a strictly rationed diet, and pollution of our water, land, and air was killing other millions. The scientists said that half of Earth's oxygen supply would be cut off in 10 years because the phytoplankton of the oceans, they furnished half the world's oxygen, you know, were dying. The oceans were polluted. The oceans? You don't believe it? Well, you died in 1890, so you find it hard to credit. But some people were predicting in 1968 exactly what did happen in 2008. I believed them. I was a biochemist. But most of the population, especially those who counted, the masses and the politicians, refused to believe until it was too late. Measures were taken as the situation got worse, but they were always too weak and too late and fought against by groups that stood to lose money if effective measures were taken. But it's a long, sad story. And if we're to build houses, we'd best start immediately after lunch. Alice came out of the river and ran her hands over her body. The sun and the breeze dried her off quickly. She picked up her grass clothes but didn't put them back on. Wilfrida asked her about them. Alice replied that they made her itch too much, but she would keep them to wear at night if it got cold. Alice was polite to Wilfrida, but obviously aloof. She had overheard much of the conversation, and so knew that Wilfrida had been a factory girl who had become a whore and then had died of syphilis. Or at least Wilfrida thought that the disease had killed her. She didn't remember dying. Undoubtedly, as she had said cheerily, she had lost her mind first. Alice, hearing this, moved even further away. Burton grinned, wondering what she would do if she knew that he had suffered from the same disease caught from a slave girl in Cairo when he had been disguised as a Muslim during his trip to Mecca in 1853. He had been cured, and his mind hadn't been physically affected, though his mental suffering had been intense. But the point was that resurrection had given everybody a fresh, young, and undiseased body, and what a person had been on earth should not influence another's attitude toward them. Should not, was not, however, would not. He couldn't really blame Alice Hargreaves. She was the product of her society. Like all women, she was what men had made her, and she had strength of character and flexibility of mind to lift herself above some of the prejudices of her time and her class. She had adapted to the nudity well enough, and she was not openly hostile or contemptuous of the girl. She had performed an act with Burton that went against a lifetime of overt and covert indoctrination, and that was on the night of the first day of her life after death, when she should have been on her knees singing hosannas because she had sinned, and promising that she would never sin again as long as she was not put in hellfire. As they walked across the plain, he thought about her, turning his head now and then to look back at her. That hairless head made her face look so much older, but the hairlessness made her look so childlike below the navel. They all bore this contradiction, old man or woman above the neck, young child below the belly button. He dropped back until he was by her side. This put him behind Frigate and Logu. The view of Logu would yield some profit, even if his attempt to talk to Alice resulted in nothing. Logu had a beautifully rounded posterior. Her buttocks were like two eggs, and she swayed as enchantingly as Alice. He spoke in a low voice. If last night distressed you so much, why do you stay with me?
Her beautiful face became twisted and ugly.
I am not staying with you. I am staying with the group.
Moreover, I've been thinking about last night, though it pains me to do so. I must be fair. It was the narcotic in that hideous gum that made both of us behave the way we did. At least I know it was responsible for my behavior, and I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Then there's no hope of repetition.
How can you ask that? Certainly not. How dare you?
I didn't force you, he said. As I have pointed out, you did what you would do if you were not restrained by your inhibitions. Those inhibitions are good things under certain circumstances, such as being the lawful wedded wife of a man you love in the England of Earth. But Earth no longer exists. Not as we knew it. Neither does England, neither does English society. And if all of mankind has been resurrected and is scattered along this river, you still may never see your husband again. You are no longer married. Remember, till death do us part. You have died, and therefore parted. Moreover, there is no giving into marriage in heaven.
You are a blasphemer, Mr. Burton. I read about you in the newspapers, and I read some of your books about Africa and India, and that one about the Mormons in the States. I also heard stories, most of which I found hard to believe. They made you out to be so wicked. Reginald was very indignant when he read your Qasida. He said he'd have no such foul, atheistic literature in his house, and he threw all your books into the furnace. If I'm so wicked, and you feel you're a fallen woman, why don't you leave? Must I repeat everything? The next group might have even worse men in it. And as you have been so kind to point out, you didn't force me. Anyway, I'm sure that you have some kind of heart beneath that cynical and mocking air. I saw you weeping when you were carrying Gwynafra, and she was crying.
You have found me out, he said, grinning. Very well. So be it. I will be chivalrous. I will not attempt to seduce you or to molest you in any way. But the next time you see me chewing the gum, you would do well to hide. Meanwhile, I give my word of honor. You have nothing to fear from me as long as I am not under the influence of the gum.
Her eyes widened and she stopped. You plan to use it again?
Why not? It apparently turned some people into violent beasts, but it had no such effect on me. I feel no craving for it, so I doubt its habit-forming. I used to smoke a pipe of opium now and then, you know, and I didn't become addicted to it, so I don't suppose I have a psychological weakness for drugs. I understood that you were very often deep in your cups, Mr. Burton. You and that nauseating creature, Mr. Swinburne.
She stopped talking. A man had called out to her, and though she didn't understand Italian, she understood his obscene gesture. She blushed all over, but walked briskly on. Burton glared at the man. He was a well-built, brown-skinned youth with a big nose, a weak chin, and close-set eyes. His speech was that of the criminal class of the city of Bologna, where Burton had spent much time while investigating Etruscan relics and graves. Behind him were 10 men, most of them as unprepossessing and as wicked-looking as their leader, and 5 women. It was evident that the men wanted to add more women to the group. It was also evident that they would like to get their hands on the stone weapons of Burton's group. They were armed only with their grails or with bamboo sticks.
Chapter 11. Burton spoke sharply and his people closed up. Kaz didn't understand his words, but he sensed at once what was happening. He dropped back to form the rear guard with Burton. His brutish appearance and the hand axe in his huge fist checked the Bolognese somewhat. They followed the group, making loud comments and threats, but they didn't get much closer. When they reached the hills, however, the leader of the gang shouted a command, and it attacked. The youth with the close-set eyes, yelling, swinging his grail at the end of the strap, ran at Burton. Burton gauged the swing of the cylinder and then launched his bamboo spear just as the grail was arcing outward. The stone tip went into the man's solar plexus and he fell on his side with the spear sticking in him. The subhuman struck a swinging grail with a stick, which was knocked out of his hand. He leapt inward and brought the edge of the hand axe against the top of the head of his attacker, and that man went down with a bloody skull. Little Lev Ruach threw his grail into the chest of a man and ran up and jumped on him. His feet drove into the face of the man who was getting up again. The man went backward. Ruach bounded up and gashed the man's shoulder with his chert knife. The man, screaming, got to his feet and raced away. Frigget did better than Burton had expected him to, since he had turned pale and begun shaking when the gang had first challenged them. His grail was strapped to his left wrist, while his right held a hand axe. He charged into the group, was hit on the shoulder with a grail, the impact of which was lessened when he partially blocked it with his grail and he fell on his side. A man lifted a bamboo stick with both hands to bring it down on Frigget, but he rolled away, bringing his grail up and blocking the stick as it came down. Then he was up, his head butting into the man and carrying him back. Both went down, Frigget on top, and his stone axe struck the man twice on the temple. Alice had thrown her grail into the face of a man and then stabbed at him with the fire-sharpened end of her bamboo spear. Logu ran around to the side of the man and hit him across the head with her stick so hard that he dropped to his knees. The fight was over in 60 seconds. The other men fled with their women behind them. Burton turned the screaming leader onto his back and pulled his spear out of the pit of his stomach. The tip had not gone in more than half an inch. The man got to his feet and, clutching the streaming wound, staggered off across the plains. Two of the gang were unconscious but would probably survive. The man Frigget had attacked was dead. The American had turned from pale to red and then back to pale, but he didn't look contrite or sickened. If his expression held anything, it was elation and relief. He said, "That was the first man I've ever killed. The first." "I doubt that it'll be the last," Burton said, "unless you're killed first." Ruach, looking at the corpse, said, "A dead man looks just as dead here as on earth. I wonder where those who are killed in the afterlife go. If we live long enough, we might find out. You two women gave a very fine account of yourselves." Alice said, "I did what had to be done," and walked away. She was pale and shaking. Logu, on the other hand, seemed exhilarated. They got to the Grailstone about 30 minutes before noon. Things had changed. Their quiet little hollow contained about 60 people, many of whom were working on pieces of chert. One man was holding a bloody eye into which a chip of stone had flown. Several more were bleeding from the face or holding smashed fingers. Burton was upset, but he could do nothing about it. The only hope for regaining the quiet retreat was that the lack of water would drive the intruders away. That hope went quickly. A woman told him that there was a small cataract about 1.5 miles to the west. It fell from the top of the mountain down the tip of an arrowhead-shaped canyon and into a large hole which it had only half filled. Eventually it should spill out and take a course through the hills and spread out on the plain. Unless, of course, stone from the mountain base was brought down to make a channel for the stream. "Or we make water pipes out of the big bamboo," Frigget said. They put their grails on the rock, each carefully noting the exact location of his, and they waited. He intended to move on after the grails were filled. A location halfway between the cataract and the Grailstone would be advantageous, and they might not be so crowded. The blue flames roared out above the stone just as the sun reached its zenith. This time the grails yielded an antipasto salad, Italian black bread with melted garlic butter, spaghetti and meatballs, a cupful of dry red wine, grapes, more coffee crystals, 10 cigarettes, a marijuana stick, a cigar, more toilet paper and a cake of soap, and 4 chocolate creams. Some people complained that they didn't like Italian food, but no one refused to eat. The group, smoking their cigarettes, walked along the base of the mountain to the cataract. This was at the end of the triangular canyon, where a number of men and women had set up camp around the hole. The water was icy cold. After washing out their containers, drying them, and refilling the buckets, they went back in the direction of the Grailstone. After a 30 miles, they chose a hill covered by pines except for the apex on which a great iron tree grew. There was plenty of bamboo of all sizes growing around them. Under the direction of Kaz and of Frigget, who had spent a few years in Malaysia, they cut down bamboo and built their huts.
These were round buildings with a single door and a window in the rear and a conical thatched roof. They worked swiftly and didn't try for nicety, so that by dinner time everything except the roofs was finished. Frigate and Monat were picked to stay behind as guards, while the others took the grails to the stone. Here they found about 300 people constructing lean-tos and huts. Burton had expected this. Most people wouldn't want to walk a half mile every day, three times a day, for their meals. They would prefer to cluster around the grail stones. The huts here were arranged haphazardly and closer than necessary. There was still the problem of getting fresh water, which was why he was surprised that there were so many here, but he was informed by a pretty Slovene that a source of water had been found close by only this afternoon. A spring ran from a cave almost in a straight line up from the rock. Burton investigated. Water had broken out from a cave and was trickling down the face of the cliff into a basin about 50 feet wide and 8 deep. He wondered if this was an afterthought on the part of whoever had created this place. He returned, just as the blue flames thundered. Kaz suddenly stopped to relieve himself. He didn't bother to turn away. Logu giggled. Tanya turned red. The Italian women were used to seeing men leaning against buildings wherever the fancy took them. Wilfrida was used to anything. Alice surprisingly ignored him as if he were a dog, and that might explain her attitude. To her, Kaz was not human and so couldn't be expected to act as humans were expected to act. There was no reason to reprimand Kaz for this just now, especially when Kaz didn't understand his language. But he would have to use sign language the next time Kaz proceeded to relieve himself while they were sitting around and eating. Everybody had to learn certain limits, and anything that upset others while they were eating should be forbidden. And that, he thought, included quarreling during mealtimes. To be fair, he would have to admit that he had participated in more than his share of dinner disputes in his lifetime. He patted Kaz on top of the bread-loaf-shaped skull as he passed him. Kaz looked at him, and Burton shook his head, figuring that Kaz would find out why when he learned to speak English. But he forgot his intention, and he stopped and rubbed the top of his own head. Yes, there was a very fine fuzz there. He felt his face, which was as smooth as ever, but his armpits were fuzzy. The pubic area was, however, smooth. That might be a slower growth than scalp hair, though. He told the others, and they inspected themselves and each other. It was true. Their hair was returning, at least on their heads and their armpits. Kaz was the exception. His hair was growing out all over him, except on his face. The discovery made them jubilant. Laughing, joking, they walked along the base of the mountain in the shadow. They turned east then and waded through the grass of four hills before coming up the slope of the hill they were beginning to think of as home. Halfway up it they stopped. Silent. Frigate and Monat hadn't returned their calls. After telling them to spread out and to proceed slowly, Burton led them up the hill. The huts were deserted, and several of the little huts had been kicked or trampled. He felt a chill as if a cold wind had blown on him. The silence, the damaged huts, the complete absence of the two was foreboding. A minute later, they heard a halloo and turned to look down the hill. The skinheads of Monat and Frigate appeared in the grasses, and then they were coming up the hill. Monat looked grave, but the American was grinning. His face was bruised over the cheek, and the knuckles of both hands were torn and bloody. "We just got back from chasing off 4 men and 3 women who wanted to take over our huts," he said. "I told them they could build their own, and that you'd be back right away and beat hell out of them if they didn't take off. They understood me all right. They spoke English. They had been resurrected at the Grail Stone, a mile north of ours, along the river. Most of the people there were Triestans of your time, but about 10 altogether were Chicagoans who died about 1985. The distribution of the dead sure is funny, isn't it? There's a random choice operating along here, I'd say. Anyway, I told them what Mark Twain said, the devil said. You Chicagoans think you're the best people here, whereas the truth is you're just the most numerous. That didn't go over very well. They seemed to think that I should be buddy-buddies with them because I was an American. One of the women offered herself to me if I'd change sides and take their part in appropriating the huts. She was the one who was living with 2 of the men. I said, nah. They said they'd take the huts anyway, and over my dead body if they had to. But they talked more brave than they were. Monat scared them just by looking at them, and we did have the stone weapons and spears. Still, their leader was whipping them up into rushing us when I took a good, hard look at one of them. His head was bald, so he didn't have that thick, straight black hair, and he was about 35 when I first knew him. And he wore thick, shell-rimmed glasses then, and I hadn't seen him for 54 years. But I stepped up closer, and I looked into his face, which was grinning just like I remembered it, like the proverbial skunk, and I said, "Lem? Lem Sharko? It is Lem Sharko, isn't it?" His eyes opened then, and he grinned even more, and he took my hand. My hand, after all he'd done to me, and he cried out as if we were long-lost brothers. "It is! It is! It's Pete Friggett! My God, Pete Friggett!" I was almost glad to see him, and for the same reason he said he was glad to see me. But then I told myself, this is the crooked publisher that cheated you out of $4,000 when you were just getting started as a writer and ruined your career for years. This is the slimy schlock dealer who cheated you and at least 4 other writers out of a lot of money and then declared bankruptcy and skipped. And then he inherited a lot of money from an uncle and lived very well indeed, thus proving that crime did pay. This is the man you have not forgotten, not only because of what he did to you and others, but because of so many other crooked publishers you ran into later on. Burton grinned and said, "I once said that priests, politicians, and publishers would never get past the gates of heaven, but I was wrong. That is, if this is heaven." "Yeah, I know," Friggett said. "I've never forgotten that you said that. Anyway, I put down my natural joy at seeing a familiar face again, and I said, Sharko?"
"With a name like that, he got you to trust him," Alice said.
"He told me it was a Czech name that meant trustworthy. Like everything else he told me, it was a lie. Anyway, I just about convinced myself that Monat and I should let them take over. We'd retire, and then we'd run them out when you came back from the Grailstone. That was a smart thing to do. But when I recognized Sharko, I got so mad, I said, grinning, Gee, it's really great to see your face after all these years, especially here where there are no cops or courts. And I hit him right in the nose. He went over flat on his back with his nose spouting blood. Monat and I rushed the others, and I kicked one, and then another hit me on the cheek with his grail. I was knocked silly. But Monat knocked one out with the butt of his spear and cracked the ribs of another. He's skinny, but he's awful fast. And what he doesn't know about self-defense or offense. Sharko got up then, and I hit him with my other fist, but only a glancing blow along his jaw. It hurt my fist more than it hurt his jaw. He spun around and took off, and I went after him. The others took off, too, with Monat beating them on the tail with his spear. I chased Sharko up the next hill and caught him on the downslope and punched him, but good. He crawled away, begging for mercy, which I gave him with a kick in the rear that rolled him howling all the way down the hill. Friggett was still shaking with reaction, but he was pleased. "I was afraid I was going to turn chicken there for a while," he said. "After all that had been so long ago and in another world, and maybe we're here to forgive our enemies and some of our friends and be forgiven. But on the other hand, I thought maybe we're here so we can give a little back of what we had to take on Earth. What about it, Lev? Wouldn't you like a chance to turn Hitler over a fire? Very slowly over a fire?"
"I don't think you could compare a crooked publisher to Hitler," Ruach said.
"No, I wouldn't want to turn him over a fire. I might want to starve him to death or feed him just enough to keep him alive. But I wouldn't do that. What good would it do? Would it make him change his mind about anything? Would he then believe that Jews were human beings? No, I would do nothing to him if he were in my power, except kill him so he couldn't hurt others. But I'm not so sure that killing him would mean he'd stay dead. Not here."
"You're a real Christian," Friggett said, grinning.
"I thought you were my friend," Ruach said.
Chapter 12. This was the second time that Burton had heard the name Hitler. He intended to find out all about him, but at the moment everybody would have to put off talking to finish the roofs on the huts. They all pitched in, cutting off more grass with the little scissors they had found in their grails, or climbing the iron trees and tearing off the huge, triangular, green and scarlet lace leaves. The roofs left much to be desired. Burton meant to search around for a professional thatcher
and learn the proper techniques. The beds would have to be, for the time being, piles of grass, on top of which were piles of softer iron tree leaves. The blankets would be another pile of the same leaves.
"Thank God, or whoever, that there is no insect life," Burton said.
He lifted the gray metal cup, which still held 2 ounces of the best scotch he had ever tasted.
"Here's to whoever. If he had raised us just to live on an exact duplicate of Earth, we'd be sharing our beds with 10,000 kinds of biting, scratching, stinging, scraping, tickling, blood-sucking vermin."
They drank, and then they sat around the fire for a while and smoked and talked. The shadow darkened. The sky lost its blue, and the gigantic stars and great sheets, which had been dimly seen ghosts just before dusk, blossomed out.
The sky was indeed a blaze of glory.
"Like a Sime illustration," Frigate said. Burton didn't know what a Sime was. Half of the conversation with the non-19th centurions consisted of them explaining their references and he explaining his. Burton rose and went over to the other side of the fire and squatted by Alice. She had just returned from putting the little girl Gwenafra to bed in a hut. Burton held out a stick of gum to Alice and said, "I just had half a piece. Would you care for the other half?" She looked at him without expression and said, "No, thanks." "There are 8 huts," he said. "There isn't any doubt about who is sharing which hut with whom, except for Wilfreda, you and me."
"I don't think there's any doubt about that," she said.
"Then you're sleeping with Gwenafra?" She kept her face turned away from him. He squatted for a few seconds and then got up and went back to the other side and sat down by Wilfreda.
"You can move on, Sir Richard," she said. Her lip was curled. "Lord grab me, I don't like being second choice. You could have asked her where nobody could have seen you. I got some pride, too."
He was silent for a minute. His first impulse had been to lash out at her with a sharp-pointed insult, but she was right. He had been too contemptuous of her. Even if she had been a whore, she had a right to be treated as a human being, especially since she maintained that it was hunger that had driven her to prostitution, though he had been skeptical about that. Too many prostitutes had to rationalize their profession. Too many had justifying fantasies about their entrance into the business. Yet her rage at Smithson and her behavior toward him indicated that she was sincere. He stood up and said, "I didn't mean to hurt your feelings."
"Are you in love with her?"
Wilfreda said, looking up at him.
"I've only told one woman that I ever loved her," he said.
"Your wife?"
"No. The girl died before I could marry her."
"And how long was you married?"
29 years, though it's none of your business."
"Lord, grab me. All that time, and you never once told her you loved her?"
"It wasn't necessary," he said, and walked away.
The hut he chose was occupied by Monat and Kaz. Kaz was snoring away, Monat was leaning on his elbow and smoking a marijuana stick. Monat preferred that to tobacco because it tasted more like his native tobacco. However, he got little effect from it. On the other hand, tobacco sometimes gave him fleeting but vividly colored visions. Burton decided to save the rest of his dream gum, as he called it. He lit up a cigarette, knowing that marijuana would probably make his rage and frustration even darker. He asked Monat questions about his home, Gurk. He was intensely interested, but the marijuana betrayed him, and he drifted away while the Seton's voice became fainter and fainter.
"Cover your eyes now, boys,"
Gilchrist said in his broad Scots speech. Richard looked at Edward. Edward grinned and put his hands over his eyes, but he was surely peeking through the spaces between his fingers. Richard placed his own hands over his eyes and continued to stand on tiptoe. Although he and his brother were standing on boxes, they still had to stretch to see over the heads of the adults in front of them. The woman's head was in the stock by now. Her long brown hair had fallen over her face. He wished he could see her expression as she stared down at the basket waiting for her, or for her head, rather.
"Don't peek now, boys," Gilchrist said again.
There was a roll of drums,
A single shout and the blade raced downward, and then a concerted shout from the crowd mingled with some screams and moans, and the head fell down. The neck spurted out blood and would never stop. It kept spurting and spurting while the sun gleamed on it. It spurted out and covered the crowd, and though he was at least 50 yards from her, the blood struck him in the hands and seeped down between his fingers and over his face, filling his eyes and blinding him and making his lips sticky and salty. He screamed, "Wake up, Dick," Monat was saying. He was shaking Burton by the shoulder. "Wake up! You must have been having a nightmare." Burton, sobbing and shivering, sat up. He rubbed his hands and then felt his face. Both were wet, but with perspiration, not with blood. "I was dreaming," he said. "I was just 6 years old and in the city of Tours, in France, where we were living then. My tutor, John Gilchrist, took me and my brother, Edward, to see the execution of a woman who had poisoned her family." "It was a treat," Gilchrist said. "I was excited, and I peeked through my fingers when he told us not to watch the final seconds when the blade of the guillotine came down. But I did. I had to. I remember getting a little sick in my stomach, but that was the only effect the gruesome scene had on me. I seemed to have dislocated myself while I was watching it. It was as if I saw the whole thing through a thick glass, as if it were unreal, or I was unreal. So I wasn't really horrified." Monat had lit another marijuana. Its light was enough so that Burton could see him shaking his head. "How savage! You mean that you not only killed your criminals, you cut their heads off, in public, and you allowed your children to see it?"
"They were a little more humane in England," Burton said. "They hung the criminals."
"At least the French permitted the people to be fully aware that they were spilling the blood of their criminals," Monat said. "The blood was on their hands. But apparently this aspect did not occur to anyone. Not consciously, anyway. So now, after how many years, 63, you smoke some marijuana, and you relive an incident which you had always believed did not harm you. But this time you recoil with horror. You screamed like a frightened child. You reacted as you should have reacted when you were a child. I would say that the marijuana dug away some deep layers of repression and uncovered the horror that had been buried there for 63 years.
"Perhaps," Burton said.
He stopped. There was thunder and lightning in the distance. A minute later a rushing sound came, and then the patter of drops on the roof. It had rained about this time last night, about 3 in the morning, he would guess, and this second night it was raining about the same time. The downpour became heavy, but the roof had been packed tightly, and no water dripped down through it. Some water did, however, come under the back wall, which was uphill. It spread out over the floor, but did not wet them, since the grass and leaves under them formed a mat about 10 inches thick. Burton talked with Monat until the rain ceased, approximately half an hour later. Monat fell asleep. Kaz had never awakened. Burton tried to get back to sleep, but couldn't. He had never felt so alone, and he was afraid that he might slip back into the nightmare. After a while he left the hut and walked to the one which Wilfrida had chosen. He smelled the tobacco before he got to the doorway. The tip of her cigarette glowed in the dark. She was a dim figure sitting upright in the pile of grass and leaves.
"Hello," she said. "I was hoping you would come."
"It's the instinct to own property," Burton said. "I doubt that it's an instinct in man," Frigate said. "Some people in the 1960s, that is, tried to demonstrate that man had an instinct which they called the territorial imperative, but
I like that phrase. It has a fine ring to it," Burton said.
"I knew you'd like it," Frigate said. "But Ardrey and others tried to prove that man not only had an instinct to claim a certain area of land as his own, he also was descended from a killer ape, and the instinct to kill was still strong in his heritage from the killer ape, which explained national boundaries, patriotism, both national and local, capitalism, war, murder, crime, and so forth. But the other school of thought, or of the temperamental inclination, maintained that
All these are the results of culture, of the cultural continuity of societies dedicated from earliest times to tribal hostilities, to war, to murder, to crime, and so forth. Change the culture and the killer ape is missing. Missing because he was never there, like the little man on the stairs. The killer was the society, and society bred the new killers out of every batch of babies. But there were some societies composed of pre-literates, it's true, but still societies that didn't breed killers. And they were proof that man was not descended from a killer ape. Or I should say he was perhaps descended from the ape, but he didn't carry the killing genes any longer, any more than he carried the genes for a heavy supraorbital ridge, or hairy skin, or thick bones, or a skull with only 650 cubic centimeters capacity. That's all very interesting, Burton said. We'll go into the theory more deeply at another time. Let me point out to you, however, that almost every member of resurrected humanity comes from a culture which encouraged war and murder and crime and rape and robbery and madness. It is these people among whom we are living and with whom we have to deal. There may be a new generation someday, I don't know, it's too early to say since we've only been here for 7 days. But like it or not, we are in a world populated by beings who quite often act as if they were killer apes. In the meantime, let's get back to our model. They were sitting on bamboo stools before Burton's hut. On a little bamboo table in front of them was a model of a boat made from pine and bamboo. It had a double hull across the top of which was a platform with a low railing in the center. It had a single mast, very tall, with a fore and aft rig, a balloon jib sail, and a slightly raised bridge with a wheel. Burton and Frigate had used chert knives and the edge of the scissors to carve the model of the catamaran. Burton had decided to name the boat when it was built the Hadji. It would be going on a pilgrimage, though its goal was not Mecca. He intended to sail it up the river as far as it would go. By now, the river had become the river. The two had been talking about the territorial imperative because of some anticipated difficulties in getting the boat built. By now, the people in this area were somewhat settled. They had staked out their property and constructed their dwellings or were still working on them. These ranged all the way from lean-tos to relatively grandiose buildings that would be made of bamboo logs and stone, have 4 rooms and be 2 stories high. Most of them were near the Grailstones along the river and at the base of the mountain. Burton's survey completed 2 days before resulted in an estimate of about 260 to 261 people per square mile. For every square mile of flat plain on each side of the river, there were approximately 2.4 square miles of hills. But the hills were so high and irregular that their actual inhabitable area was about 9 square miles. In the 3 areas that he had studied, he found that about one-third had built their dwellings close to the riverside Grailstones and one-third around the inland Grailstones. 261 persons per square mile seemed like a heavy population, but the hills were so heavily wooded and convoluted in topography that a small group living there could feel isolated, and the plain was seldom crowded except at mealtimes, because the plains people were in the woods or fishing along the edge of the river. Many were working on dugouts or bamboo boats with the idea of fishing in the middle of the river, or, like Burton, of going exploring. The stands of bamboo had disappeared, although it was evident that they would be quickly replaced. The bamboo had a phenomenal growth. Burton estimated that a 50-foot-high plant could grow from start to finish in 10 days. His gang had worked hard and cut down all they thought they would need for the boat, but they wanted to keep thieves away, so they used more wood to erect a high fence. This was being finished the same day that the model was completed. The trouble was that they would have to build the boat on the plain. It could never be gotten through the woods and down the various hills if it were built on this side. "Yeah, but if we move out and set up a new base, we'll run into opposition," Frigate had said. "There isn't a square inch of the high grass border that isn't claimed. As it is, you have to trespass to get to the plain. So far, nobody has tried to be hard-nosed about their property rights, but this can change any day. And if you build the ship a little back from the high grass border, you can get it out of the woods okay and between the huts, but you'd have to set up a guard night and day, otherwise your stuff will be stolen. Or destroyed. You know these barbarians."
He was referring to the huts wrecked while their owners were away, and to the fouling of the pools below the cataract in the spring. He was also referring to the highly unsanitary habits of many of the locals. These wouldn't use the little outhouses put up by various people for the public. "We'll erect new houses and a boatyard as close to the border as we can get," Burton said. "Then we'll chop down any tree that gets in our way, and we'll ram our way past anybody who refuses us right away." It was Alice who went down to some people who had huts on the border between the plain and the hills and talked them into making a trade. She didn't tell anybody what she intended. She had known of three couples who were unhappy with their location because of lack of privacy. These made an agreement and moved into the huts of Burton's gang on the 12th day after resurrection, on a Thursday. By a generally agreed-upon convention, Sunday, the 1st, was Resurrection Day. Ruach said he would prefer that the first day be called Saturday, or even better, just First Day, but he was in an area predominantly Gentile, or ex-Gentile, but once a Gentile, always a Gentile, so he would go along with the others. Ruach had a bamboo stick on which he kept count of the days by notching it each morning. The stick was driven into the ground before his hut. Transferring the lumber for the boat took 4 days of heavy work. By then, the Italian couples decided that they had had enough of working their fingers to the bone. After all, why get on a boat and go someplace else when every place was probably just like this? They had obviously been raised from the dead so they could enjoy themselves. Otherwise, why the liquor, the cigarettes, the marijuana, the dream gum, and the nudity? They left without ill feelings on the part of anybody. In fact, they were given a going-away party. The next day, the 20th of year 1 AR, two events occurred, one of which solved one puzzle, and the other of which added one, though it wasn't very important. The group went across the plain to the Grailstone at dawn. They found two new people near the Grailstone, both of them sleeping. They were easily aroused, but they seemed alarmed and confused. One was a tall, brown-skinned man who spoke an unknown language. The other was a tall, handsome, well-muscled man with gray eyes and black hair. His speech was unintelligible until Burton suddenly understood that he was speaking English. It was the Cumberland dialect of the English spoken during the reign of King Edward I, sometimes called Longshanks. Once Burton and Frigate had mastered the sounds and made certain transpositions, they were able to carry on a halting conversation with him. Frigate had an extensive reading vocabulary of early Middle English, but he had never encountered many of the words or certain grammatical usages. John de Greystock was born in the manor of Greystoke in the Cumberland country. He had accompanied Edward I into France when the king invaded Gascony. There he had distinguished himself in arms, if he was to be believed. Later he was summoned to Parliament as Baron Greystoke, and then again went to the wars in Gascony. He was in the retinue of Bishop Antony Beck, Patriarch of Jerusalem. In the 28th and 29th years of Edward's reign, he fought against the Scots. He died in 1305 without children, but he settled his manor and barony on his cousin Ralph, son of Lord Grimthorpe, in Yorkshire. He had been resurrected somewhere along the river among a people about 90% early 14th century English and Scottish and 10% ancient Sybarites. The peoples across the river were a mixture of Mongols of the time of Kublai Khan and some dark people, the identity of which Greystoke didn't know. His description fitted North American Indians. The 19th day after resurrection, the savages across the river had attacked. Apparently they did so for no other reason than they wanted a good fight, which they got. The weapons were mostly sticks and grails because there was little stone in the area. John de Greystoke put 10 Mongols out of commission with his grail and then was hit on the head with a rock and stabbed with the fire-hardened tip of a bamboo spear. He awoke, naked, with only his grail, or a grail, by this grailstone. The other man told his story with signs and pantomime. He had been fishing when his hook was taken by something so powerful that it had pulled him into the water. Coming back up, he had struck his head on the bottom of the boat and drowned. The question of what happened to those who were killed in the afterlife was answered. Why they were not raised in the same areas as in which they died was another question. The second event was the failure of the Grails to deliver the noonday meal.
Instead, crammed inside the cylinders were 6 cloths. These were of various sizes and of many different colors, hues, and patterns. 4 were obviously designed to be worn as kilts. They could be fastened around the body with magnetic tabs inside the cloth. 2 were of thinner, almost transparent material, and obviously made as brassieres, though they could be used for other purposes. Though the cloth was soft and absorbent, it stood up under the roughest treatment and could not be cut by the sharpest chert or bamboo knife. Mankind gave a collective whoop of delight on finding these towels. Though men and women had by then become accustomed, or at least resigned to nudity, the more aesthetic and the less adaptable had found the universal spectacle of human genitalia unbeautiful, or even repulsive. Now they had kilts and bras and turbans. The latter were used to cover up their heads while their hair was growing back in. Later, turbans became a customary headgear. Hair was returning, everywhere, except on the face. Burton was bitter about this. He had always taken pride in his long mustachios and forked beard. He claimed that their absence made him feel more naked than the lack of trousers. Wilfrida had laughed and said, "I'm glad they're gone. I've always hated hair on men's faces. Kissing a man with a beard was like sticking my face in a bunch of broken bedsprings."
Chapter 13. 60 days had passed. The boat had been pushed across the plain on big bamboo rollers. The day of the launching had arrived. The Hadji was about 40 feet long and essentially consisted of 2 sharp-prowed bamboo hulls fashioned together with a platform, a bowsprit with a balloon sail and a single mast, fore and aft rigged with sails of woven bamboo fibers. It was steered by a great oar of pine, since a rudder and steering wheel were not practicable. Their only material for ropes at this time was the grass, though it wouldn't be long before leather ropes would be made from the tanned skin and entrails of some of the larger river fish. A dugout, fashioned by Kaz from a pine log, was tied down to the foredeck. Before they could get it into the water, Kaz made some difficulties. By now, he could speak very broken and limited English and some oaths in Arabic, Baluchi, Swahili, and Italian, all learned from Burton.
"Must need. What you call it? Voila. What it word? Kill somebody before place boat on river. You know. Merda. Need word, Burton Nock. You give Burton Nock. Word. Word. Kill man so god. Kabur kaga grubems. Water god. No sink boat. Get angry. Drown us. Eat us."
"Sacrifice," Burton said.
"Many bloody thanks, Burton Nock. Sacrifice. Cut. Throat. Put on boat. Rub it on wood. Then water god not mad at us."
"We don't do that," Burton said. Kaz argued, but finally agreed to get on the boat. His face was long, and he looked very nervous. Burton, to ease him, told him that this was not Earth, it was a different world, as he could see at a quick glance around him, and especially at the stars. The gods didn't live in this valley. Kaz listened and smiled, but he still looked as if he expected to see the hideous green-bearded face and bulging fishy eyes of Kabur Kana Krubems rising from the depths. The plain was crowded around the boat that morning. Everybody was there for many miles around, since anything out of the usual was entertainment. They shouted and laughed and joked. Though some of the comments were derisive, all were in good humor. Before the boat was rolled off the bank into the river, Burton stood up on its bridge, a slightly raised platform, and held up his hand for silence. The crowd's chatter died away, and he spoke in Italian.
"Fellow Lazari, friends, dwellers in the valley of the Promised Land, we leave you in a few minutes,
if the boat doesn't capsize," Frigate muttered,
"to go up the river against the wind and the current. We take the difficult route because the difficult always yields the greatest reward. If you believe what the moralists on Earth told us, and you know now how much to believe them."
Laughter, with scowls here and there from die-hard religionists. "On Earth, as some of you may know, I once led an expedition into deepest and darkest Africa to find the headwaters of the Nile.
I didn't find them, though I came close, and I was cheated out of the rewards by a man who owed everything to me, a Mr. John Hanning Speak. If I should encounter him on my journey upriver, I will know how to deal with him."
"Good God," Frigate said, "would you have him kill himself again with remorse and shame?
But the point is that this river may be one far, far greater than any Nile, which, as you may or may not know, was the longest river on earth, despite the erroneous claims of Americans for their Amazon and Missouri-Mississippi complexes. Some of you have asked why we should set out for a goal that lies we know not how far away, or that might not even exist. I will tell you that we are setting sail because the unknown exists, and we would make it the known. That's all. And here, contrary to our sad and frustrating experience on Earth, money is not required to outfit us or to keep us going. King Cash is dead, and good riddance to him. Nor do we have to fill out hundreds of petitions and forms and beg audiences of influential people and minor bureaucrats to get permission to pass up the river. There are no national borders, as yet, Frigate said, nor passports required, nor officials to bribe. We just build a boat without having to obtain a license, and we sail off without a buy or leave from any mucky muck high, middle, or low. We are free for the first time in man's history. Free. And so we bid you adieu, for I will not say goodbye.
You never would, Frigate muttered,
because we may be back 1,000 years or so from now. So I say adieu. The crew says adieu. We thank you for your help in building the boat and for your help in launching us. I hereby hand over my position as Her British Majesty's Consul at Trieste to whomever wishes to accept it and declare myself to be a free citizen of the world of the river. I will pay tribute to none, owe fealty to none, to myself only will I be true.
Do what thy manhood bids thee do, from none but self expect applause. He noblest lives and noblest dies, who makes and keeps his self-made laws, Frigate chanted.
Burton glanced at the American but didn't stop his speech. Frigate was quoting lines from Burton's poem, The Qasida of Haji Abdu al-Yazdi. It was not the first time that he had quoted from Burton's prose or poetry, and though Burton sometimes found the American to be irritating, he couldn't become too angry at a man who had admired him enough to memorize his words. A few minutes later, when the boat was pushed into the river by some men and women and the crowd was cheering, Frigate quoted him again. He looked at the thousands of handsome youths by the waters, their skins bronzed by the sun, their kilts and bras and turbans wind-moved and colorful. And he said, "Ah, gay the day with shine of sun, and bright the breeze, and blithe the throng, met on the riverbank to play, when I was young, when I was young." The boat slid out, and its prow was turned by the wind and the current downstream, but Burton shouted orders and the sails were pulled up, and he turned the great handle of the paddle so that the nose swung around, and then they were beating to windward. The Haji rose and fell in the waves, the water hissing as it was cut by the twin prows. The sun was bright and warm. The breeze cooled them off. They felt happy, but also a little anxious as the familiar banks and faces faded away. They had no maps nor travelers' tales to guide them. The world would be created with every mile forward. That evening, as they made their first beaching, an incident occurred that puzzled Burton. Kaz had just stepped ashore among a group of curious people when he became very excited. He began to jabber in his native tongue and tried to seize a man standing near. The man fled and was quickly lost in the crowd. When asked by Burton what he was doing, Kaz said, "He not got, it," and he pointed at his forehead. Then he traced several unfamiliar symbols in the air. Burton meant to pursue the matter, but Alice, suddenly wailing, ran up to a man. Evidently, she had thought he was a son who had been killed in World War I. There was some confusion. Alice admitted that she had made a mistake. By then, other business came up. Kaz didn't mention the matter again, and Burton forgot about it. But he was to remember.
Exactly 415 days later, they had passed 24,900 Grail Rocks on the right bank of the river. Tacking, running against wind and current, averaging 60 miles a day, stopping during the day to charge their grails and at night to sleep, sometimes stopping all day so they could stretch their legs and talk to others besides the crew, they had journeyed 24,900 miles. On Earth, that distance would have been about once around the equator. If the Mississippi, Missouri, Nile, Congo, Amazon, Yangtze, Volga, Amur, Huang, Lena, and Zambezi had been put end to end to make one great river, it would still not have been as long as that stretch of the river they had passed. Yet the river went on and on, making great bends, winding back and forth. Everywhere were the plains along the stream, the tree-covered hills behind, and, towering, impassable, unbroken, the mountain range. Occasionally the plains narrowed and the hills advanced to the river edge. Sometimes the river widened and became a lake 3 miles, 5 miles, 6 miles across. Now and then the line of the mountains curved in toward each other and the boat shot through canyons where the narrow passage forced the current to boil through and the sky was a blue thread far, far above and the black walls pressed in on them. And always there was humankind. Day and night, men, women, and children thronged the banks of the river, and in the hills were more. By then, the sailors recognized a pattern. Humanity had been resurrected along the river in a rough chronological and national sequence. The boat had passed by the area that held Slovenes, Italians, and Austrians who had died in the last decade of the 19th century. Had passed by Hungarians, Norwegians, Finns, Greeks, Albanians, and Irish. Occasionally they put in at areas which held peoples from other times and places. One was a 20-mile stretch containing Australian aborigines who had never seen a European while on Earth. Another 100-mile length was populated by Tocharians, Logu's people. These had lived around the time of Christ in what later became Chinese Turkestan. They represented the easternmost extension of Indo-European speakers in ancient times. Their culture had flourished for a while, then died before the encroachment of the desert and invasions of barbarians. Through admittedly hasty and uncertain surveys, Burton had determined that each area was, in general, comprised of about 60% of a particular nationality and century, 30% of some other people, usually from a different time, and 10% from any time and place. All men had awakened from death circumcised. All women had been resurrected as virgins. For most women, Burton commented, this state had not lasted beyond the first night on this planet. So far, they had neither seen nor heard of a pregnant woman. Whoever had placed them here must have sterilized them, and with good reason. If mankind could reproduce, the river valley would be jammed solid with bodies within a century. At first, there seemed to be no animal life but man. Now it was known that several species of worms emerged from the soil at night, and the river contained at least 100 species of fish, ranging from creatures 6 inches long to the sperm whale-sized fish, the river dragon which lived on the bottom of the river 1,000 feet down. Frigate said that the animals were there for a good purpose. The fish scavenged to keep the river waters clean. Some types of worm ate waste matter and corpses. Other types served the normal function of earthworms. Gwenafra was a little taller. All the children were growing up. Within 12 years, there wouldn't be an infant or adolescent within the valley if conditions everywhere conformed to what the voyagers had so far seen. Burton, thinking of this, said to Alice, "This Reverend Dodgson friend of yours, the fellow who loved only little girls, he'll be in a frustrating situation then, won't he?" "Dodgson was no pervert," Frigate said. "But what about those whose only sexual objects are children? What will they do when there are no more children? And what will those who got their kicks by mistreating or torturing animals do? You know, I've regretted the absence of animals. I love cats and dogs, bears, elephants, most animals. Not monkeys, they're too much like humans, but I'm glad they're not here. They can't be abused now. All the poor, helpless animals who were in pain or going hungry or thirsty because of some thoughtless or vicious human being. Not now.